Hi, I'm Marianne Salmon, and I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program. On behalf of the program and the entire Department of English, we're very pleased to welcome you to tonight's STERM reading and workshop celebration and scholarship announcement. The STERM is a number of awards and a workshop that's made possible through the generosity of the STERM family in memory of Virginia Butt STERM. And our writer this year and our visitor for the week is Janice Ray, who's over here. Miss America, wave. Janice has already been here for a day or so, and we've had a lot of meals, and we've had a lot of fascinating conversation, and I'm sure tonight will be more of the same. A few things before we get going. First of all, if you're not at our last reading, the Gary Fink reading a couple weeks ago, you did not hear my little spiel about the punch, so I'm going to tell it to you, and this will be the last time. In a moment of executive decision, I got rid of the punch, because I don't think it's good for you. But John Bryant, is he here? I'm going to make a note of that. He told me that he loves the punch, and he was kind of crushed. And my friend Paige told me that it reminds her of cotillion. So how could I get rid of it? I don't know what to say to that. But anyway, I think the punch is very potent, and we should not drink it casually. So if you have strong feelings, though, and you want it back, you let me know directly. Otherwise, no more punch. And that's not even cost savings. I just don't think it's any good. I'm sorry. But the cookies are here, the Flying WV cookies. And this weekend, Tim Sweet and I went to the football game, which was awesome. And it occurred to me, Tim, that the Mountaineer has never come to one of our events. You know, and Jesse was telling me that he goes to everything, like every night. So I feel that, you know, if he's that, available to that many events, he could come to our event with his gun or whatever. So I'm going to work on that. So anyway, that's sort of the business side of things. So now we have two STERM announcements. The STERM sponsors this week and a STERM undergraduate scholarship, right, just for general undergraduates, and then the STERM creative writing scholarship, and that goes to a English major who is doing the creative writing concentration. It's a very narrow pool there. And that person is given a $1,000 scholarship, and this year's winner is Caleb Stacy. Caleb, will you stand up, please? Let me stand up. Caleb also won last year, just FYI, so we have high hopes for him. And I saw him earlier today. He's our Calliope editor, and he asked me if he would have to say anything tonight. And I said no, but that you'd have to stand up and stay standing, but you didn't do that. But anyway, I'm sure we'll be in touch within the next 24 hours. We always are. And now I want to introduce our STERM workshop participants, and I need my program to do that. And these are undergraduates and graduates who submitted their work and were judged by faculty and selected to be part of this week's workshop, so they'll work with Janice all week. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night. She thought Friday night, too, believe it or not. But, no, I just disabused her of that notion. So that'll be an intense week for them. So when I call your name, if you could stand up and stay standing so we can get a good long look at you so that later on we can see if there are any changes. Okay, Emily Denton. You can maybe hold your applause, you know, as they say. Rebecca Doverspike. Melissa Ferrone. Mariah Fowler, Marianne Hudak, Alice Jones, Fagan Jones, I'm sorry, Jesse Kelvitis, Jesse Lewis, Barrett Lipkin. Barrett, why are you sitting in the second row? Okay, Barrett's a first year, I don't know what to tell you. Hannah McPherson, Isabel Shepherd, and Sadie Shore Parks. Congratulations. You may sit. Thank you. Good job. Okay. I'm trying to inspire fear in them. I don't know if you can tell that or not. Okay, I think that's it. Now I'm going to happy to turn it over to Jesse Kelvitis, who's going to introduce Janice, and then we'll get to hear a great reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. I'm Jesse Kelvitis. I'm a third-year creative nonfiction student here. And actually, Janice Ray's writing and I go back a little bit longer than I had realized. I first encountered her book, Ecology of a Cracker Childhood, in 2009. I was living in Pensacola, Florida, and there wasn't a lot to do, so I was roaming around the library, which is pretty much what I do even when there's a lot to do. And the title caught my eye, Ecology of a Cracker Childhood. I think my first thought was a what of a what? The whats were soon answered. I had actually stumbled into an amazing book, and it was the best possible introduction to both the cultures and the ecosystems of the Deep South, which, coming from West Virginia, both strangely familiar and also very new to me. And I encountered Janice Ray's writing again a few years later, back in West Virginia, in the writing Appalachian Ecology class, when we read a few of her pieces before going out, as Katie Fallon put it, to lean against a rock and write. We went out into the Freneau Experimental Forest, and Janice's piece, Forest Beloved, helped us to appreciate the intricate beauty of place and to be more precise and focused in our own observations. And now it's autumn. It's a time for contemplation and harvest, maybe even the harvest of some winter squash. In her 2012 book, The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food, Janice Ray quotes an Iowa gardener as saying, "Squash plants are smarter than people. They only take on one project at a time. The plant says, I've got enough to do. If it's a big squash like a Hubbard, it may only make one fruit per vine. The squash says, I'll make a hell of a squash. Or it finishes one squash and then says, now I can make another." Food for thought. Whether psychoanalyzing squash or retelling the creation myth from the point of view of a longleaf pine, Janice Ray brings elegance and insight to her topic. Join me, please, now in welcoming Janice Ray.
If you haven't heard what's happening with seeds, let me tell you. They're disappearing, about like everything else. You know the story already. You know it better than I do. The forest and the songbirds, the Appalachian Mountains, the fish in the ocean. But I'm not going to talk about anything that will make us feel hopeless or despairing, because there's no despair in a seed. There's only life waiting for the right conditions, sun and water, warmth and soil, to be set free. Every day, millions upon millions of seeds lift their two green wings. Thank you all so much for giving up this part of this beautiful evening for us to be together and for you to hear me. And thank you for having me at West Virginia University. I have to tell you, it's my real first time visiting, like staying for a while in West Virginia. So I'm totally happy to be here. And they have me down at the Hotel Morgan, which is this awesome historic place. Like, the ghosts in there talk to you and stuff. And it's like, it's awesome. Thank you very much. I'm going to read tonight from The Seed Underground. It veered definitely from my normal work, which is as a nature writer. So for many, many years, my first book came out in 99, and it was a book about a forest that Jesse mentioned. Thank you, Jesse. During those days when I went around and traveled to universities and talked to students, the conversations were, can we reintroduce the red wolf to the east? Can we bring back the red wolf? Is the ivory-billed woodpecker extinct? And as I traveled and spoke with students, these were the conversations that lit them on fire. And over the years, you know as well as I do, that we have a lot of hopeless environmental and biological stories. I mean, is there anything more sad than mountaintop removal, really? Nothing. Nothing. We're blowing off the tops of the oldest mountains in the world. Like, is a mountain not sacred and holy? Is it not God's creation and we're blowing off the tops? The conversations in turning to hope that young people were having were, can we start a community garden on campus? Can we get Cisco, our cafeteria, to take local food? And that was the reason I wrote this book. I had come to a place in my life where I didn't have so much hope. You know, we're looking at climate change looming over us. Looming. So here's really why I wrote it. There's one page in the beginning I want to read. I'm standing under the saddest oak that ever was. A young man who as a child climbed this very tree has died, fallen from a balcony during a party. For his memorial, there are no pews, altar, or casket. A circle of friends and family congregate in the yard of his mother, my friend. One tattooed man, about 25, remembers how his buddy helped him through depression. Another young man behind me steps forward to speak, stumbles, and throws his arm around my waist. His kind eyes are bloodshot, and he breathes out small alcoholic clouds. He steadies himself and delivers a short poem, words scribbled in blue ink on a sheet of paper like hieroglyphics. This man is the age of my son, as could be any of them, young people searching for beauty and meaning, struggling to understand the events of the epoch. They are so young to be so familiar with grief. As we stand in the Florida sunshine, a broken pipe from an exploded rig leaks millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf. We could be holding a funeral for the Gulf or the climate, any number of things. I feel around me a cavernous hopelessness, but I do not feel hopeless. Many systems that we've been living amid and on which we collectively rely appear to be failing. The easiest thing to do is give up, but so much needs to be done, every mind and body crucial for putting new systems in place. We don't need people to drop out. On the way home from the service, I was listening to bluegrass when I heard this question: what will you be building when you're called away? This book is for everyone, but it's especially for you young people, in hopes that given all the bad, you start building. Not skyscrapers or oil rigs, but lives that make sense, that contribute to a lighter, more intelligent, more beautiful way of living on the earth. Lives lived as far outside and beyond corporate control as possible. That in doing so you find meaning, that you attain higher planes before drugs or alcohol enslave you, that you inhabit the country of love, that you find happiness. Here in the country, on a little farm in southern Georgia, I'm building a life, a quiet life of resistance. I'm a radical peasant, and every day I take out my little hammer and I keep building. Seeds are only a small part of life, but they represent everything else, all my relations. So what's happening to seeds is this. In 2005, two researchers at the University of Georgia did a study in looking at seeds that were available 100 years ago. The USDA actually published a catalog of varieties available commercially. And they found that in that 100-year time span, that agrodiversity had declined 94%, that 94% of the seeds available at the turn of the in 1901 were not available in 2005. 94%. That's 94% of cabbages gone, 94% of apple varieties. And you know yourself that used to, you could go into the apple orchards of West Virginia and find Greenings and Arkansas Blacks and all these amazing apples. Did you know at the turn of the 1900s, we had 7,000 varieties of apples in this country? And now you go into the grocery store and what you have are Granny Smith, Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, Fuji, you know, a few more. The same with all of it. I have this amazing collard green growing in the garden now called Green Glaze Collard. If you garden, and I don't want to bore you if you don't garden, so I'm not going to, you don't have to garden to think about seeds and care about what you eat. This collard tastes like no collard you've ever seen. Mostly people will grow Vates collards or Georgia collards. This has emerald green, shiny, I don't even know the word for it, kind of iridescent leaves. If I blindfolded you and fed you a Georgia collard or a green glaze collard, you could taste the difference. Just like kale. You know, all kale's not kale. There's lacinato kale, which is that long dinosaur tongue stuff. There's red Russian kale. I grow an heirloom variety called green peas, which is a red Russian. Has a reddish purple stem. Then there's that curly kale called dwarf blue curl that you see on most salad bars. They all differ from each other in taste and in nutrients. Now, before I read you a chapter in the book, I want to tell you there's actually a better part of the seed story, of that seed statistic, than I've told you, and there's a worse part. And the better part is this, that about 7,000 open pollinated varieties were available at the turn of the century, and about the same number are available now. So what happened? Like 94% are gone. So what's made up the difference? The difference are accessions that we have in from other countries, like more Swiss chards, just different varieties, you know, African okras, or these folk varieties that plantsmen and plantswomen have gone out across the country, found, and reintroduced to the marketplace, like Moon and Stars watermelon. You guys seen that? Big green watermelon with yellow splotches. So, because at every college I visit, young people are fascinated by the food system, because the food system is a way that we can change our lives. We may not be able to outlaw mountaintop removal and send the country careening towards solar energy, but by golly, we can determine what we eat. Also, do you really want corporations to feed you? Do you want industry whose motive is profit to feed you? Isn't it funny that here I am, this proselytizer in the creative writing department. Me growing up, let me tell you the bad news. First, my grandfather grew a kind of seed corn. A seed starts to adapt to its microclimate in 1 year of growing. So if your grandfather's growing a corn, it will, and it's an open pollinated corn. Y'all know, that means you can save the seeds and get back exactly what you planted. In 1 year, it starts to adapt to the drought, the rain, the temperatures of that place. My grandfather grew this seed corn, which he every year fed his mules and then saved a few coffee cans full to replant year after year. Over just a few years, that corn was genetically diverse from any other corn in this country, in the world. And yet that corn, my grandfather, Arthur Branch corn, was never available commercially. So it would have never made it to the USDA Guide of Commercial Varieties in 1901. All those unnamed, vintage, local, mom-and-pop, heirloom varieties are mostly gone. When I grew up in the 60s and 70s among South Georgia's flat gray fields, our culture was agrarian. Seeds were currency, seeds were gifts, seeds were steaming bowls of the future. My grandmother Beulah held stock in this economy. She loved plants and all they produced. She had an ingenious and fascinating greenhouse, a pit house dug into a red clay bank beside the dirt road. From the outside, the house looked about 4 feet high, covered in plastic sheeting. When you pulled open its little door, concrete block steps led 3 feet down to a small earthen room with damp walls, ferny and mossy, a basement without a house. The pit house was steamy and hot and smelled like geraniums. The air was algaic. It was so green. We children had to ask permission to go into the pit house. A child had to move carefully there. She could not knock off blooms or break stems. She had to watch for snakes. She had to care about what she was seeing. After my grandmother was too old to care for it, the greenhouse was dismantled and the pit filled with clay, but not yet. For a while, I could learn her wisdom. I could observe her movements among African violence. I could watch clean water gushing from the hose. My heart first opened to gardens in the time of cowpeas.
I remember one day, it happened before my mother stopped wearing pants, before she adopted a religion that forbade them. On this day, she wore dark blue petal pushers because she had come to her mother's garden, since she herself did not have a garden. She had a junkyard, what she and my father called a wrecking yard. She had come to help put up peas. My skinny, gentle sister was wearing pants with little flowers on them and flat-bottom sneakers of light blue. She was six, holding my hand. I was two. My mother was picking, hoping my baby brother back at the house with Grandma would stay asleep long enough for her to fill her pails. With this many children, three so far, how to even find time to put food by? My uncle was also in the pea patch, helping harvest the peas that Mama and Grandma would shell back on the porch. My sister walked me toward the edge of the garden. The peas had grown out of their lines and tangled together, making an undulating sea that threatened to wash over us. "Sis, watch out for snakes," my uncle called. All the females in my family get called sis. "Maybe y'all best go back to the house. I'd hate to see a snake bite you." The vines smelled like thunder. I didn't think there were snakes beneath the big leaves. I stepped into them. I tripped and fell. My uncle looked up but didn't say anything. I got up, brushed my palms together. My sister grasped my hand again. She listened better than I. I pulled away. I reached for a long, thin fruit. It was born in me to eat that fruit. My mother was picking, picking. She couldn't pick one lime green pod and sit down among the leaves and begin to chew as I could. Its taste was strange. I arrived at the moist round pea, tasted stranger. I chewed it with my new teeth. "Mama," my sister yelled, "she's eating the peas." My mother turned her heart-shaped face toward me. It was often turned elsewhere. "You're going to have a bellyache," she said. I was glad she didn't tell us to go back. I looked at her and smiled and kept chewing so fat my face unfolded when I smiled. I didn't know how to say what I was feeling. "I don't guess they'll hurt her," my mother said to herself, as much as to my uncle. She was filling an enamel milk bucket. We would spend the afternoon taking these peas from their shelves and tossing the empty pods into bushel baskets. I would play in the pods. I knew my mother was tired. I knew she needed more sleep. But she was young. She was still in love with my father. She would always be in love with him. She had found her calling. I stood unsteadily among the tripping vines, clutching the fat pods with my fat hands. "Peas," my mother said. "Can you say that?" I looked at her figure, tall and thin against a blinding sun, squinted, then grinned the fat grin. "Peas," I said. The only gardening mentor I had was not saving seed because she understood genetic erosion. She was saving seed because she had learned how to do it when she was young. She had always done it, and it was a natural thing to do. She moved about her kitchen with her graying hair clipped short, baking lemon cakes and filling her pantry with pear chutney. I was young in her kitchen when I saw my grandmother scraping squash pulp to dry on paper napkins smoothed on a pie plate. "What are those?" I asked, making my voice small. I knew to be polite, to ask only crucial questions, those to make adults feel important. "Kashaw," she said proudly. "Kashaw, a funny word, like a sneeze. What is that?" "Oh, a kind of pumpkin." "Do you eat the seeds?" "No, child, you plant them," she said, "to grow more kashaws." She looked at me with a mixture of love and pity. "We'll dry them and plant them in the garden next year, so more pumpkins will grow." After supper, I knew my grandmother would go out to rock and watch the hummingbirds in the impatiens lining the screen porch, and she would let me climb up onto her lap. My grandmother had a soft bosom. Her house dress felt electric against my cheek. She smelled like the talcum powder in the round container on her dresser. "Grandma, will you show me how to grow kashaw?" I asked. "I will," she said, laughing, "but I don't know how much growing you'll do with you starting school this year." I am immensely grateful for everything Beulah taught me. Without her, where would I be? The branches grow because of the tree, says a native Hawaiian proverb. We are here because of our ancestors. Some years later, my grandmother gave me the first heirloom seeds I ever began to save. Although neither I nor she knew the terms heirloom or vintage. By the time my sister, brothers, and I had trooped through the front door that Saturday morning, she had picked a hamper of zipper cream peas, and we spent the morning helping shell them. At lunch, I noticed a handful of strange seeds in a cut glass bowl on a buffet in the dining room. I waited until she finished cooking. I waited until after lunch. I waited until my sister and I washed all the dishes in the low sink, the one built for a woman barely 5 feet tall. Grandma, what are these? I asked. The beans were large as eyeballs. They looked like eyes, white with dark irises. Sis Ermelu gave me those. She called them jack beans. Can you eat them? Ermelu said she thought you could, and I don't think I'd attempt it. I wanted one of those eyeballs. To steal one would be a sin, I knew, so I needed to ask to word my questions carefully. Are you going to plant them? I did already. Are these extra? You might say that. I'd like to try planting one. Well, honey, help yourself. That was all I needed. The seeds felt like oblong marbles in my hand. Why are they called jack beans? I asked. After Jack and the beanstalk, I reckon, she says. They grow high? You'll have to plant them and see, she says. Thank you, Grandma. We're almost done with this chapter. Every year, through the mesmerizing and tumultuous narrative of my childhood, I planted, I watched, I learned, and sometimes I harvested. I was still sowing that garden the year I was a senior in high school, newly 18, when my friends were dating and drinking and going to movies, and I was most definitely not. Because my parents strictly did not allow such carrying on. The nature of my life was apparent in a journal entry dated May 14th, 1980, a Wednesday only a few weeks before I graduated from high school. I was 18 years old. The boys to whom I refer were my two brothers, 1 and 2 years younger, both of whom could drive long before I. I had a job after school shelving books at the public library. And then there's a little indent, and here's the journal entry. The boys picked me up from work this afternoon, and we went out to Thompson Farm Supply. I love feed and seed stores. I got a pound of peanuts, $1, a scoop of squash, 20 cents, and a big packet of turnip seed. At the grocery store the other day, I'd bought some of those colorful packets, okra, marigold, dwarf zinnia. I sowed the grainy turnip seed in a 3-foot bed with a rake. I made rows and planted squash and okra. Then I hoed out a few weeds. The wind came up. It got cooler, but the clouds didn't collect. Finally, around 9, Mom and I were jogging. It began to sprinkle. Rain has fallen lightly since. Grow, grow, grow. 18 years old? What was I thinking? I sound like a 10-year-old. Why wasn't I sneaking out my window at night to join friends driving back and forth between the Dairy Queen and the Methodist Church? Soon enough, I was out in the world, seeing it for myself, as much of it as I could. In a world where there was so much to love, I came to love plants and, accordingly, seeds. So I'm going to skip a little section here and get into where I am now with another part, a part of another chapter. Let me just lecture you for one more minute. I think what happened to seeds was the industrialization of agriculture. You know, I don't really have anything per se against hybridization. So what happened was in the 1920s in this country, seed companies began to introduce hybrids. And especially seed corn, there were thousands and thousands of varieties of corn, you know, field corn, number two corn, seed corn, being grown before 1920. Farmers were often plagued with Stewart's bacterial wilt. And a couple of geneticists, plant breeders, developed a corn that was resistant, a hybrid corn that was resistant to this bacteria. And once that corn hit the marketplace, the hardware store shelves, farmer after farmer, and who could blame them? A farmer needs to earn a living, abandoned their old varieties of corn and started growing this new hybrid variety. Well, the problem with a hybrid is that it's a cross between two unlike parents. And when you grow out the seeds of that fruit, the fruit of that plant, you get back any of the genetic ancestors used in breeding that seed, but you don't get what you planted. So let me just give you an example of a hybrid right now. Let me just talk to you about a zucchini. A zucchini that's a green zucchini with gold stripes, and it's a hybrid. You plant it, save the seed. The next year plant those, you may get some gold zucchinis, some yellow squash looking things, some real zucchini looking things. Then in 1996, Monsanto pushed through a technology called GMOs. Now, GMOs are laboratory developed seeds that are made by basically shooting DNA from one kingdom of life, possibly, into another. So you could literally have pig genes in plant material. Now, I'm not opposed to technology in any form per se. I am opposed to technology that is not very well thought out, that is not introduced and developed in the public interest, and that has at heart profit. Because we can trace agriculture back 12,000 years. The history of human beings is a history of the seeds that we have used to eat. If corporations take seeds from us, then they have stolen our food supply. It's like the subtitle of this book is A Growing Revolution to Save Food, and I'm not kidding you. We're talking about being able to save food. So let me skip ahead. I had to write a What Can You Do page at the back of this book, knowing that most people don't even have gardens. Most people are, 80% of people in the United States now live in urban centers. So what do those people do? Well, first, I'll just tell you, number one on the list is eat real food, which means you got to figure out what real food is. And I will tell you, when you go to the grocery store and you're walking down the aisle of cereals and all these cereals are here and they're industrially produced, that is not real food. It's not. It's mostly wheat. I could get into wheat. Eat real food. Know the people that produce your food. Get to know the farmers. If we have some kind of climatic, if things are going to get rough, I promise you that. So if you have a local food system in place, you may be able to keep eating. Knowing, having studied the environment and environmental crises all my life, all my adult life, my husband and I started looking for a farm. We live in southern Georgia on Red Earth Farm, which you can Google and see what we do there. We have tons of workshops, like how to make cheese. We have all kinds of animals, and I'll just name you a few. We have cows, which we milk, goats, which we milk, sheep, turkeys, chickens, guineas, rabbits, a beautiful Flemish giant rabbit, very tasty. Peacocks. Seems like, hogs. And we work our butts off there. We actually make soap and make wine and make beer. Like really great beer. Beer, by the way, is stupid simple to make. And if you're out there paying big money for beer, you can do it yourself at home. And I can show you how. And I can show you for free how. So, and we have big gardens, and part of the reason is we would like to be able to feed ourselves and our families no matter what, and we want to control what we eat. I try not to eat industrial meat. I came here on the train. I quit flying 5 years ago, and behind me, the last leg of the train from Baltimore to here is actually a shuttle. The train, Amtrak, quit running this line, apparently. And behind me in the shuttle were two women who got off in Cumberland. And you can see they were very pretty women, long blonde hair, but uneducated and had probably had some association with the drug world. You know, I heard them talking a lot about snorting and doing some things. They were right behind me, and they were talking loud, and they were cursing a lot. And, of course, you know, it's like, do I mind my own business in a situation like that? No, I'm a writer. That is my business, you know? I heard everything they were saying. One of them works at a chicken plant plucking chickens at night. So I started talking to her. She actually is the person who looks at the chicken to make sure there are no sores or anything on it, make sure it looks okay. She arranges it right before it goes into something called the injector. What do you think they're injecting? Something. I think it's salt water, actually. I better shut up and get reading so we can finish up here. I had in mind what I was... Okay, sometimes I dream a tree birthed me. I came tumbling like an apple out of its limbs. I came to a causeway and looked out across my father and mother's faces, which were shining in the sun. I saw many beautiful things. I saw love in the eyes of deer. I saw the throats of lilies moving. And I wanted a farm. I wanted a farm at the border of wilderness. I could not escape the terrible yearning. Even as I was becoming a nature rider, seeking wildness and spending halcyon days walking through the remaining tracts of longleaf pine flatwoods, I battled a piece of myself that is happiest not in wilderness, but on a farm. I had come to think of a societal continuum that begins with wildness on one end, hunting and gathering for food, moving through agrarianism, which is settling down and tending a piece of land, then through industrialism, an urban life, into technologism, whatever that lifestyle is. A tract of land can sustain a forest or a farm, or, wait a minute, where am I? A forest or a farm, or a manufacturing plant, or a bank of computers operated by robots. If wildness is on the right, I want all movement in terms of land use to be toward the right, always toward wildness. But though my hope for land is that it tends toward wild, the truth is that I am probably happiest somewhere in the middle. My friend Rick Bass once said to me, what I would want after working in the fields would be to step away from the plow and enter an old forest where I could walk and rest at the end of a day of hard work. Once Silas left for college, every morning soon after I woke, the longing accosted me. My mind turned to thoughts of what my life would be like had I a place of my own. How, if I had land, trees, fields, how different my decisions would be. I think perhaps the feeling derived from the idea of cultus, which is to care for, and the instinct to care for something. I needed something to cultivate after Silas left. Every morning, my thoughts arrived at the same question, where is this place? Part of the urgency my husband and I felt about finding it was the growing body of evidence substantiating collapse, especially of the climate, and not simply the knowledge, but the experience of it. During the 2 years of our search, the South emerged from a severe drought. Tornadoes in March were ransacking towns, tearing down schools and neighborhoods, killing people. More and more, the statistics pointed to the need to be settled in a community and able to provide at least some of one's own basic needs. During the second September of a long search, I had a gut-wrenching dream. A storm was coming. I had been at a gathering of people, many of them friends, and worry had descended. It was palpable. I was leaving with Silas when suddenly he and I were standing on the edge of outer space, on the perimeter of the very atmosphere. Around us, the biosphere was blue, all shades of blue, swirling, something you might see if you were doing psychedelic mushrooms. I knew the blue meant ice. The blue hues were eddying, dragged around by monolithic winds. We could feel the cold wind all around us. I felt amazed and also helpless, and I remember thinking that at least Silas and I were together. Where the colors were powder blue, I knew the ice had started to melt. So that was the catastrophe. But now the ice was beginning to solidify again, and the whirling winds were turning all colors, rainbow colors, bright and vivid. We made offerings of what we had, which was strips of potatoes. Then a man appeared. I didn't know him, and neither did Silas, but the man was holding a baby. That would become the important fact. That's all of the dream I remember. And maybe that's all there was. I've never studied dream interpretation. But I know it was both a dream of warning and of hope. A millennia encapsulated, a collapse and a rebuilding. There was hope in the colors and in the baby. The house was two stories and painted green with forest trim. Its metal roof was green. It was built in 1850 using native long leaf in the federal style. It sat on 46 acres, to the north and south large pastures, to the east a mature pecan grove where wild onions scented the fall air, and beyond that ran a dirt road. The farm was located in the delta of two rivers, each a couple miles away. To the east, the pristine Ohoopee carved its way through white sand, joining the fat Altamaha south. I'm going to skip some here. A lot, actually, because I just want to read you the end. Then it's summer. So I'm telling you, what the part I skipped is about getting the farm together. I was eager to get my 13th and last garden planted. Then it's summer, and the pigeon peas are taller than my head. They are 8 feet tall, flowering way up there in the most astonishing and giddy scarlet. I have risen from weeding a few stray plants, pigweed and purslane, and a chinaberry sprout from beneath the forest of pigeon pea stalks. I hear the distinctive twittering of a hummingbird. It is a ruby throat, feeding at the pulse flowers above me and making more noise than I think necessary. I stand still. The hummingbird flies away and lands on the hogwire fence that surrounds the garden. Then I notice a smaller hummingbird a foot away on the same fence. A good deal of animated hummingbird conversation is underway at the fence. Another bird zips from a pecan tree nearby and into the flowers. My face is a daylight moon staring up through composite leaves below a field of flowers. I'm 2 feet from a couple of the birds, which are careless, and I realize they are fledglings. They are leaving a nest nearby. They appear to be learning from their parents how to suckle nectar. They are very excited. For a long time, I do not move. They are not startled. And I watch the two young and their parents darting in awkward, helter-skelter ways between blossoms. But unable to hover for long, they careen back to the enclosure wire to rest. I watch until they all fly away through the blue swirling biosphere. And one last piece I want to read to you before we end. But before I read this little piece, I want to ask you if you have any questions. I've jumped around a little bit, told you a little bit about seeds, a little bit about growing up, the farm I live on. Does anybody have any question about sustainable ag, about creative writing, about how I live or why I live? About, yes, Catherine.
Where do you find, with all the stuff you're doing on the farm, where do you find time to write?
Yeah, that's very, she asked, with all the stuff we do on the farm, where do I find time to write? And that's very, very difficult. It is. I actually don't write. Isn't that crazy? I don't. You know, writers have the, okay, this is just confession night here. Nobody's filming it. Writers have always had, you know, they get up at 6 a.m, they set one alarm clock by the bed, another out in the hall, so they cut this one off and that one's ringing and they do their work before everybody else wakes up. I actually like, I've only been married 12 years to this really handsome guy, and I like laying in bed with him in the morning. And so I'm going to stay there. And with writing, what has happened is that, I hate to say it, but fewer and fewer people read. And when I'm 51, so when I was first becoming a writer, writing a book, writing really meant something. It meant you could be Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and your writing would lead to the restoration of the Everglades. And on and on and on. You could write Silent Spring, which would lead to the bald eagle being taken off the endangered species list. And I have become a little more wary of writing and a little less, it's just not so much a glamour job to me anymore. I actually like making cheese, you know? I do. So I do write, but I usually just write when I want to write. And it's when I get on a project, and then I write as a job. I write all day long. And then I go for many months where I don't write at all. So I'm not the kind of person who's trying to fit writing in some other career, you know? I don't. And when I'm writing, I skip lunch. I do whatever, the minimum of what is necessary, and I completely immerse myself in what I'm doing. And I actually had an epiphany. We adopted a little girl 16 months ago who came from a very traumatic place, and I have been 24/7 focused on trying to heal this little 9-year-old girl who was so desperately, she suffered such desperate trauma that I've been doing a ton of research and, sorry. And I think that we can win. So my office has gotten, you know, as a writer, people still love writers. They're still like in love with us, which I don't understand because they hardly even read us. But they write me these letters, and I get these letters, like piles of letters, and people send me gifts and their books and their magazine articles, and I can't even read it all. And it stacks up in my office. I moved 5 banana boxes of correspondence and things out of my office last week, and just yesterday, last night, at Hotel Morgan, I realized the next project that I'm going to work on. It's not the little girl, by the way. I mean, one day, I hope to win that one and write a book about how you can heal a child who suffered from childhood trauma to the degree that this child has. But I'm not going to tell you what it's about because that might spoil the magic, but it happened right here, and I will remember you guys. I'll give you in the acknowledgments. I'm going to give you an acknowledgment, West Virginia University, for bringing me that little gift of epiphany for what I should be working on. Any other questions? Did I answer that? I can't even remember what the dang question was. Yeah.
I have a question about all the stuff you said you make at your farm. You said like soap and beer. And
yeah.
Do you buy groceries or like?
Yeah, we do buy groceries, yeah.
Not completely.
No, I'd like it to be. I would say probably 70% of what we consume, we make. And I'll tell you, I ate last night at Marianne's house. She cooked for us. And she said something like, I hardly even like to eat out because my food is just better. And it is. It's true. Her food is definitely better. It is true. Restaurant food is expensive and it's not as good. But it's not as good, and we feel the same way. I mean, have a tenderloin, have filet mignon at my house, and it's a different thing than what you would get in a restaurant. And the same with even something like pesto. You know, you're never going to just get pesto at my house with basil because there's going to be other things you can throw in it. There's cilantro right now or wild onions or, you know, food is really good at my house. It is. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you said you run workshops there?
Yes, I do. Not so much. We canceled most of them just working on our little girl, but it'll come back. When she's ready to be around people again, yeah, it'll happen.
What do you think is the most underutilized crop in a small garden?
Underutilized crop in a small garden. It's going to have to be greens because you can grow so many greens in a little amount of space, and they are packed with nutrients. So it would be something like Swiss chard or kale or something like that. I told somebody, Jesse, I think, about we live in the subtropics, and we can't grow spinach very well except in the middle of winter. But all summer we grow this this plant called Malabar spinach, which is, it grows on a vine, and it has mucilaginous leaves like okra, but that cooks out. And you can make any spinach dish, spanakopita, you can make anything. We make omelets with it. I'll tell you something else we do. Lamb's quarters is a beautiful, it grows wild everywhere. The lamb's quarters leaves, just wash them a little bit. There's a little tiny fuzz on them. Lamb's quarters is nutrient, just so packed, rich, with all kinds of iron and other vitamins, and it is the tastiest wild green ever. Yeah. So, some wild stuff. Yes, Mark.
So your grandfather's, well, first of all, bring your beer next time to replace your mouth. Your mouth is watering. Your grandfather's story is reminiscent of farmers I worked with in Guatemala who are growing their own corn and have their own distinct varieties that are suitable to their land. But even in Guatemala, I was talking to a reporter from La Prensa Libre and said, better and be cheaper if we just bought our corn from the United States.
That's because we're subsidizing all the corn in the United States. I mean, that's welfare. That is corporate welfare, Mark.
But how do you, and I of course agree with everything you say, but how do you answer the economic argument saying, you know, to grow your own stuff is expensive? You have to put in the time, you have to build fences in this area because deer will get it. So how do you answer that argument?
Yeah, I don't think you can answer that argument economically. I really don't. I think you have to. So honestly, over time, I stopped even talking so much about the environment, and I talk mostly about economics. And I think that if we don't have a different economic system that factors in other very important variables like human health or environmental health, then you know none of the other stuff is going to ever work. I think the root cause of environmental destruction is our economic system, which is based on this model of progress or grow, grow, grow. You know, the Earth cannot support grow, grow, grow. We would need, you know, 9 planets to continue the growth of human population living the way we live. Something has to change. So my thinking is for the Guatemalan farmers to, you know, keep as much of the old ways alive as they can, because there will be a time when we cut the subsidies on all these Midwestern farmers who are destroying the Midwest. Do you know the loss of topsoil in some of those Midwestern? The prairie had like 16 feet of topsoil in places. And you can, there are places where they just mark it vanishing. So you see, we can get really hopeless and gloomy here very quickly, which is why seeds, there is an entire cadre of farmers, especially young farmers and especially women, going into this field. And I'm telling you, you're not going to make much money, but you're going to have one of the most beautiful lives there is. Does anybody know more about no-till than I do? The way it's practiced, so do you want to talk about it?
Permaculture?
Okay, so no, it's a separate thing. So, you know, if you looked at no-till and like we do it, which are raised garden beds, we found that if we plowed and did rows like the traditional chemical farmers do, that when these rain events come, like they do now, and they drop 5 or 6 inches of rain, our fields would get flooded. So we begin to use raised beds. They get raised up. So you actually dig out the aisles. Well, first of all, you double dig the bed and then dig out the aisles and put it on top. So your bed is going to be, you know, like in the ideally about this tall. And you keep adding just to the top, and we never turn it again. There's a fork, a broad fork thing that you can just loosen the dirt with if you need to. So we keep adding manure and hay and wood chips to the top of that. That or in permaculture would be true no-till agriculture. But the way it's used where we live is the tractors still run across the land, but in this case they're usually spraying chemicals. And then seeds are just planted right there. I must say it's probably a step in the right direction, but it doesn't eliminate chemicals, which I think are killing us. I know they're killing us. We should probably just take one more. Yeah. Jesse, are you okay if I get you in class? Let me get you.
I'm wondering if going to school in Missoula shaped your career outlook at all.
Did going to school in Missoula shape my career? Are you from Montana?
Well, I spent a lot of time in Missoula. So.
You did? I'd say it pretty much shaped who I am.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm going back there for 3 months to teach in the spring. It was my major professor there was Bill Kittredge. And, yeah, he taught me everything I know about writing, which I'm fixing to teach to these people in my class. So watch all of them. They're going to have books coming out, too. Anything else? Everybody okay? I want one more time to remind you of the most powerful thing in the world. It is a seed. In this era of transition between the age of industrialization and the Ecozoic era, a seed is life. Because we don't know what's sealed in it, it contains any number of surprises. Everything the seed has needed to know is encoded within it. And as the world changes, so it will discover everything it yet needs to know. That's the nature of adaptation and evolution, the two most important jobs we have on this planet, which is why I think seeds are the ultimate metaphor. Every morning I wake with fears. There are so many. I wake into the news of storms. When the storms have passed, what will we need to rebuild? We'll need seeds. There's at least one in each of you. There's a bank of seeds within you. Let them grow. I excused myself from a phone conversation the other day when I looked out the window and saw my husband trying to chase calves back into the pasture they were supposed to be, where they were supposed to be. They had been separated during the day so that Raven could milk in the evening, and they wanted to get back to their moms. I got a skedaddle, I told my friend. The calves are out. I read this quote once, my friend replied, that anyone who keeps animals will soon become slave to them. He elongated the word slave. I'm not a quick thinker, and I was outside hollering like a banshee, trying to cut a calf off and get her out of the young orchard, when I fabricated a witty retort. Anyone who does not keep animals will soon become slave to corporations. The same with farming. Anyone who does not grow food will become a slave. Agriculture has created in us a story-based, community-reliant, land-loving people. It has given us a head start on what I call the age of bells, a time when bells, cowbells, dinner bells, the bells of flowers, will again be ringing across the hills and plains. We are coming to the new age of ag better prepared, knowledgeable about growing, able to do with less, happy in our communities, firm in gender and racial equality, healthier. I believe that the local food movement is leading the way to recreating cultures that are vibrant and vital. What we are witnessing in ag is no less than a revolution. It also means we're on an edge, a lot of edges. When I think of an edge, I think first of that literal one, the fence row, which modern chemical ag has been destroying, the place where birds pooped out wild cherry seeds and the trees grew, and the place where, tired from the row, workers sat in the shade and told stories. It's where the lone farmer watched a mockingbird sing. There's also a psychological edge we're all living on. We know we're living in a world being devastated, but also one replete with the beauty and power of life. We live on the boundary of deciding to make positive contributions, although we know we are implicit in the destruction. We skate between apathy, because the truth of what's happening is painful, versus action, any kind of action. And we skitter between the paralysis caused by grief and fear versus action. Every decision we have to make is an edge. Our very psyches are on an edge between dropping out and dropping in, selling out and fighting back, every single one of us. It's important to know that one is not alone on the edge. It holds a tremendous amount of ecological and cultural as well as intellectual power. I believe we have to get comfortable with it. How shall we live? As if we believe in the future. As if every one of us is a seed, which, as you know, is a sacred thing. In my wildest dreams, the seeds of every species are speaking to us, calling out, in all the bare spots on earth, plant us and let us grow. On all the edges, plant seeds. One weekend in a storytelling workshop, I asked participants to tell stories of hope. One man told about stopping on a busy highway near Franklin, North Carolina, to rescue a box turtle only a foot from the yellow line. When he had to turn around, when he got back to the turtle, a white van had stopped in the suicide lane and had successfully rescued the reptile. I'm not the only one, the man thought. Another story was about a professor's children who were visiting their dad on campus when they decided to make a sign. Students, stop walking around doing nothing. They decorated the sign with pictures of the earth and peace signs. What I really want to say is that these stories seem small compared to the enormity of the problem. Gandhi, however, pointed out that big problems need small solutions. Big problems need one courageous and willing person. Big problems need you doing what you desire to do, but doing it with great authority, great knowledge, and great love. Maybe, just maybe, once you have picked up a tool at hand and started to work, someone will say of you, using a wonderful African proverb implying that you're attempting something far beyond what's comfortable or maybe even possible, "She has gone in search of the fabulous birds of the sea." And we're about one page away. Let's also get clear about hope. After talks, I've been asked 100 times, am I hopeful? How do I find hope? Do I stay hopeful? The assumption is that hope is a prerequisite for action. Without hope, one becomes depressed and then unable to act. For many years, I tried to say that I find hope in nature. Not long ago, somebody asked me the question again, and suddenly I thought, hope? Who needs hope? Do you feed your daughter because you have hope she'll turn out okay? Hope is important, but I want to stress that I do not act because I have hope. I act whether I have it or not. It is useless to rely on hope as motivation to do what's necessary and just and right. Why doesn't anybody ever talk about love as motivation? Let me be even more truthful. It's not hope or love. It's fight, which is love. So the question, how do I stay hopeful, becomes as ludicrous as how do I stay love-filled? I'll tell you how. I wake every morning listening to the great crested flycatcher call from the pear tree, and I watch that fat old orange sun, always burning, rise flamboyantly over the pecan orchard. I watch turnips go to seed. I watched hummingbirds and the red valentines of pigeon peas. Bottle feeding the new calves after dark, I watch bats. Before bed, I walk outside and gaze up through the bare limbs of the swamp chestnut oak into the starry, starry sky above Red Earth Farm, and I watch a meteor blaze a trail to Earth. I may not have a lot of hope, but I have plenty of love, which gives me fight. Thank you all again for coming. Thank you to these students who so courageously entered essays into the contest and got into this class. Thank you to my new friend, Katie Fallon, whose book, Cerulean Blues, I read recently and loved. And to Marianne Salmon and Mark Brazidis. Two writers, a poet and a fiction writer, who were the people who asked me to come and organized me being here. I very much look forward to a week on campus. If you need to get a hold of me, you could contact one of these people and they'll give you my email address, or if you see me walking by and want to talk, please do. One winter night, I dreamed a marvelous dream. I watched a man jump from a plane with a colorful parachute opened against a tie-dyed sky. The air swirled with colors, like one of those 6-inch-wide multicolored lollipops. Then I noticed a bicycle hanging from the parachute, and I watched the man begin to pedal through the universe. That was the totality of the dream, but when I woke, I understood it to be a dream of possibility. We are leaping into the universe, and not only will we be given a parachute to save ourselves, we will be able to steer. I say, rev up your awesome. Look around. So many people have put their shoulders into the load. You, find a place to push. Pick up a tool, a hoe, or a shovel. Start turning the compost bin to make the soil in which the seed will grow. You will begin at the center of many concentric circles that expand further and further out from you. You soon will become a local hero and rock star, and from there your influence will wash outward, even across the globe, where so many people are rising like germinating embryos to claim food sovereignty, to rescue local seeds, and guard human civilization's cornucopia. Come home. Have the courage to live the life you dream. There's nothing greater. Many of our seeds have been lost forever, but we can protect what's left. And in our revolutionary gardens, we can develop the heirlooms of the future. Begin now. Are you going to farm her up or just lay there and bleed? Thank you.